Good morning. Welcome to the Minnesota Court of Appeals. Today is Wednesday, October 19th, 2022. We have six cases on our calendar today, five are set for oral argument, four of which are in person. This is the fourth case, A22-0009, State of Minnesota versus Cameron O'Neill Clark. Counsel for appellant, you'll have 15 minutes for your initial arguments, followed by 15 minutes by respondent and 5 minutes for rebuttal by appellant, if you so choose. We do have three different podiums set up. If you want to, social distance, we've got the two on the side. The one in the middle, as you know, has the button in the middle so you can raise and lower, and it has the timer right there. So it's a little easier for you to keep track of your time. When you approach the podium, please state your name for the record, the party you're representing, and if you have any preferred ways that you would like us to refer either to you or to your client. And then we will have questions from myself, Judge Randy Slater, and Judge Jennifer Frisch. With that, counsel, you may begin.
Just to clarify, I can use the middle one?
Yes, you can. Yes.
Good morning, and may it please the court. My name is Anders Erickson. I'm an assistant state public defender, and I represent the appellant this morning, Mr. Clark. Mr. Clark is requesting that this court reverse his convictions and remand for a new trial because the district court committed reversible error by allowing the state to introduce GPS information without providing adequate foundation for the GPS information. There are four reasons why this court should find that the court erred. First, Rule 901B9 makes clear that when there is evidence that relates to a process or system, there should be evidence discussing that process or system, discussing the accuracy of it, and whether it was accurate in the case at hand. Second, while certainly not binding on this court, courts from other jurisdictions, including federal circuit courts and the Supreme Court of South Carolina, have relied on their version of Rule 901B9. Third, this is not an issue of weight versus admissibility. In order to give proper weight to evidence, there must be proper foundation for that evidence. In other words, without any testimony regarding the process or system, there was no ability to cross-examine regarding that process or system and provide the jury with information that then they could weigh to determine whether or not the evidence was reliable. Finally, if this court finds that 901B9 does not apply, there is no reason it wouldn't apply in cases with cell phone tower information, DNA evidence, or other scientific evidence. In all of those situations, we're dealing with the same thing, and that is there's a process or system that results in information being created, and there needs to be evidence regarding that process or system in order for the jury to adequately weigh it.
So, counsel, I have a couple of questions about that. At the district court level, the objection to this evidence was the lack of authenticity, a foundation objection, and also hearsay. You're not raising hearsay on appeal.
We are not raising hearsay on appeal.
So when I read the entirety of the record and your brief, it really struck me as though it wasn't necessary, that today it's not necessarily an objection that the thing isn't what she says it is, but the contents of the thing are not accurate, which is, or not reliable, which seems to fall more in the hearsay bucket than the authenticity bucket.
To respond to that, so when we're talking about authenticity, we are discussing ultimately the reliability of that data, right? We need to know what the process was or the system that created that data so we know it is what it purports to be.
Well, isn't it enough for her to testify, I put data in X and X spit out Y and this is the Y that was spit out? Isn't that enough to say it is what I say it is, which would satisfy 901B? I mean, it seems to me what you're arguing is it's not that she's, there's not enough to say this is what I say it is, but the things that are on Y are not verified or not subject to verification based on her saying, I put information into the system and it spit something out.
Right. Let me compare this to just a normal website. So if she were just to type in StarTribune.com and it comes up, she could testify that that's what happened, because we are not dealing, the issue there wouldn't be the process or the system of creating the Star Tribune website. In this case, when that information is plugged in, we are dealing with what is that system that then created the result, which is where the phone is. That's what we're wondering about. It's not the content, it's not the information, it's how that information is created. So that's why a case like this with GPS information is very different than just a regular website or a picture on a phone or anything like that. We are talking about the underlying information and where that came from and whether that is accurate. Because we have no information regarding whether there's any sort of percentages of error or how you would know that or any information regarding how it works. Again, if we were to compare.
So then let me ask about some of the substantive testimony that we got at trial about the output from the system. So as I understand it, and correct me if I'm wrong, there were three nuggets of information that were generated. One was where she was before the incident, one was that she was at the incident, and the key one is where that phone was after the incident. And she verified that the first two were accurate. She just didn't know about the third one. So why isn't the, and have I described that correctly?
Correct.
Okay. So why isn't her testimony about the system generated accurate outputs for one and two enough from which the district court could say, okay, this is a reliable system in general, or these are reliable outputs in general?
Yeah. Two responses. One, if the issue was whether she was at Walgreens or the car wash, I would be challenging that as well, because there still is no evidence regarding the system, the technology that said that she was at that place. In this case, like you correctly stated, the big issue is where that phone go from where the incident took place after. And we don't have any other corroborating evidence regarding where that phone went. If you compare that to the corroborating evidence regarding actually the location of the phone.
But aren't you trying to challenge the reliability of the system, the application on the phone?
The reliability of the GPS technology, that's correct.
And that GPS technology is part of that app that's on the phone?
Yes, possibly.
I mean, it's tied to the phone.
That's correct.
In fact, the GPS is designed to identify where the phone is located.
Correct.
So I'm struggling. Maybe I'm missing something, but I think Judge Frisch's question is spot on in terms of if she's verifying where she was with the phone before the incident, and she's verifying where she was with the phone during the incident, those are two data points to verify that the application and the GPS technology that is being used with it is actually accurate. And I don't think that was being disputed, right?
It's not being disputed because that wasn't at issue.
But I think that is at issue, because that goes to the reliability and in turn providing foundation that, one, from my perspective at least, the phone is working, two, that the application that utilizes the GPS technology to identify where the location is working, and three, you've got two data points based on her testimony indicating that that application is working. I think this would be a different question if she said, yeah, I was at the Walgreens, but the GPS technology said, no, you were at CVS, 10 miles down the road. Then I think there would be an issue here of whether or not that application and the GPS technology actually did work.
Two responses. One is, we still don't have evidence regarding the technology, even for those two data points. The second thing is, the issue in this case isn't data point A and B, it's B to C. And we have no other evidence regarding the technology if there could have been error in that information.
But
we don't know.
Now, isn't that a matter of cross-examination? This is where we get into the weight versus admissibility. So we've got her verifying the app is working the way it's working in a true and correct manner, at least in two immediate data points before the third, which is the one at issue. And then isn't it a matter of cross-examination to say, well, you don't have any verifying information that it was working in point three, and we don't have any information about the way that this technology is operating? I mean, how is that a threshold admissibility issue?
My pushback to that, Your Honor, is what you need to cross-examine about is the actual technology. So, for example, the cell phone tower evidence, it's the exact same purpose as this evidence. They had an FBI agent come in and testify regarding how cell tower communication tracking works. In order for the jury to understand the weight of that, the defense attorney cross-examined that FBI agent regarding how that technology worked. And information they received was, yes, sometimes it's not exact. Sometimes the cell phone or the tracking information doesn't actually point to the specific location. They couldn't say that it wasn't at that the other cell phone was at the apartment or the location of the incident. That's the kind of cross-examination you need in order for the jury to understand the weight
of it.
Mr.
Erickson, can I follow up on it?
Yeah.
Even with that, did that FBI agent, I assume, didn't have the expertise of the actual technological process, but more the result of it and explaining? I assume, for instance, an agent goes to training and gets an understanding that these cell towers can do it, but does the agent really have the technological expertise to know how that technology was created, that the process was created to allow us to do that, any more so than this witness would have been able to do it through the Google app?
Absolutely, because that witness was able to discuss exactly what you pointed out, how the technology works, how the information is inputted, where it comes from, where the cell towers are, all of that sort of thing, what the error rates are, how exact it can be. My argument is not that there has to be an expert witness coming in to testify. It has to be somebody who can actually discuss the process or the method in which this data is created. And that's what...
Can I ask a follow-up question? Isn't the general rule when an objector to foundation of any evidence, could be testimonial evidence or in this case a particular exhibit, have some obligation to indicate some doubt in... as part of the lack of foundation? And so what would that be, other than just saying, well, how do we know it's accurate? That seems like that's not sufficient doubt of the existing foundation, which was essentially her testimony that she used the Google app and here's what it shows and gave it to the officer.
A couple responses. First, it's the proponent of the evidence that has the burden. So every time a party introduces evidence, they have to provide sufficient foundation. Right, the other side doesn't have to poke holes in it. The other side has to provide foundation.
But the objector to the foundation that is provided, which in here the proponent believed her testimony was sufficient, doesn't that shift then to the objecting party that the foundation lacks? Well, counsel, tell me how it's lacking. What is it that you're telling? Why isn't it what she says it is?
So in that hypothetical, the person objecting would point to the rule, which defense counsel did here, and said 901B9 states that when there are issues of process or system, you need to provide evidence that regarding the process or system and whether that process or system resulted in accurate information in this case. I don't think the objector has any obligation to provide evidence regarding it. I think you point to the rule and you say this is what the rule of evidence has articulated, and that's what happened in this case. And then once that evidence is admitted, that's when we start talking about probative value and all of that sort of thing. Foundation is you have to establish foundation before you even get to the 401 and 403 analysis, and that's where potentially they could poke holes at the reliability of it. But the first issue is whether there is sufficient foundation for the evidence. Again, I want to point out that if this court were to disagree with this analysis, in a case where there was DNA evidence, for example, someone who creates the DNA evidence could just email it or text message to a witness the summary, and then that witness could just testify about it. And that would be no different than in this case, because the person would have the summary, just like the witness did in this case, and they could just testify to it. And that would be sufficient foundation under the state's theory in this case.
That's a little different, though, because we're putting information in and it's spitting out a report. I mean, it's not, I mean, a layperson doesn't put DNA information in and get a report about DNA.
And I think that highlights my argument, because a layperson isn't putting in the data in this case. The data comes from the program. Whoever is touching the buttons on the phone, they're not the ones who are actually doing the scientific part of the technology. And that's the same as with DNA evidence, where if the scientists are doing it and then they send the report to the person reads the summary and then testifies about it and says, yeah, I received it, I looked at it, I've seen this before, and then that would be sufficient foundation, and that would be a big problem.
It might be sufficient foundation because it is what the person says it is, but they'd have a hearsay problem, and they'd have a, you know, they'd have an expert problem, a science problem.
Not for a data. A data issue wouldn't be hearsay in that situation. There might be other confrontation issues, but just looking at the foundation, it would be the exact same scenario, and no court has found that. And same with the cell tower. I mean, why would the state have a witness come in and provide a PowerPoint and pages and pages of testimony regarding how that cell tower data works, and then just have a GPS information from a lay witness? It's the exact same evidence. And one is requiring foundation and the other isn't, and that's a problem. If the court doesn't have any other questions regarding that, I can move on to the harm analysis.
Well, actually, you might have to save that for your rebuttal.
Okay.
Since you're just about out of time here. But we appreciate the discussion on the GPS, because that is a significant issue that we wanted to discuss.
Okay, sounds good. Thank you.
Thank you, counsel. Counsel for respondent, you will have 15 minutes as well, and you can lower and adjust. And please say your name for the record, party you're representing, any preferences in terms of how we should address you or your client. And please be mindful of the time as well.
Good morning. Thank you, Your Honor. And may it please the court, counsel. I'm Assistant Hennepin County Attorney Peter Marker for the state. Your Honors, appellant is asking this court to identify a certain type of evidence and say from now on what type of foundation is required for that type of evidence. And I strongly encourage this court not to do that. That is not what Rule 901 requires. Rule 901 creates a very low threshold for admissibility, and in this case, screenshots, and are they what the witness purport them to be? Now, we've been talking about three data points here today, but I submit there are five data points with regard to this evidence. When she left her home, Walgreens, the car wash, Banneker, where the assault occurred, and the fifth, appellant's residence. And so her testimony was that she went to all those places, consistent with the timeline represented in the screenshots. And we know she was at Banneker because we have video of her there getting assaulted. And so that is consistent with the screenshot.
But isn't this really issue comparable to laying foundation for a cell tower, like we had here with an FBI agent testifying as to how the technology works, what limitations it has, so that there can be good cross-examination of to, you know, essentially be able to poke holes that, hey, you know what, it functions, it works, but it doesn't work 100% all the time. You can have dead spots. You can have times when it's not working well. And it seems to me that isn't this a comparable situation? Because shouldn't you have somebody testify as to that same level of foundation to say, this is how GPS technology works. This is how the limitations. You can have dead spots. It can be shut off. It's not 100% accurate, so that there would be meaningful cross-examination in that setting as well.
Your Honor, this goes to a point. It's certainly a fair question. This goes to a point that appellant wishes to equate all evidence. All evidence is different.
Well, I respectfully disagree with the equivalent to, for instance, DNA evidence, because I think that's a completely separate issue. But I think the cell tower, that's getting a little closer.
Maybe it's closer on a spectrum, but cell tower evidence is subject to interpretation and analysis.
I think it's more than just subject to interpretation and analysis. I think it's subject to questioning as to the reliability of that technology.
Sure.
And I think the issue here is GPS, how reliable is GPS technology? And I don't think that question is being answered here.
Your Honor, I think respectfully disagree, that's not the question here. The question here is whether or not the screenshots are what the witness purported them to be. And that question begs another question: is there indicia of reliability suggest that they are? And there is, because of her testimony and the other evidence. Sorry, Judge.
No, that's okay. I was just going to follow up. But how does that differ from, rather than laying the foundation for the cell tower, the deputies say, well, how do you know where the phone is? Well, it pinged off of here, and it pinged from here and here and there. It is what it is. I'm trying to understand that distinction. And she just took a screenshot, and they just got a printout or whatever they get, you know, from the cell companies to say where it went. Why is that not sufficient foundation then for that data?
Your Honor, it's not, because the cell tower evidence requires interpretation and evaluation and explanation. And those are complicated processes that go into that. And that did require, for foundational purposes, that level of interpretation.
Isn't that just to be able to identify the particular phone? Because there's other, obviously, a bunch of phones are pinging at any one time. Isn't that really the only interpretation? We just want to know if this particular phone was pinging and what locations it was pinging.
Well, if you read the FBI agent's evaluation of that evidence, and again, that's not why we're here. We're not here to talk. The cell tower evidence
is not an issue.
But
I'm trying to understand the distinction.
No, I understand
the comparison.
She
just did a screenshot, but they just got a printout. And yeah, it needed interpretation, but it obviously went into a lot more foundation about the success rate, the accuracy of it, and et cetera.
But the interpretation, Your Honor, is more complex. It's more involved. It's a bit of an art when it's talking about the coverage areas for those cell towers and the determination of where that phone is, talking now about appellant's phone. But with regard to the victim's phone here, screenshots saying, look, this is where my phone was, and I know it's accurate because I was there.
Let me just clarify. She wasn't there with the cell phone after it had been stolen. That's really the key difference here. Yes, she could vouch as to where it was. If the issue was, where was the cell phone at 10:44 while I was at home and it was with me? Here's a screenshot. It was with me. But she did not have her cell phone at the end.
Right, and Your Honor, and she can be cross-examined on that, and that goes to the weight of the evidence.
But you're reducing it down. You're saying it's just a matter of a screenshot, but it's more than that, because it goes to, what does the screenshot represent? And the screenshot represents the use of technology, GPS technology, to identify where the phone was located.
Just like a photograph relies on technology, correct?
This isn't just a matter of, this is just a screenshot of the cell phone, of what the cell phone looks like. There's data, and there's a process, and there's technology that the cell phone is taking a snapshot of, and it's more than just a static 2D picture. There's all this. There's, like the cell phone tower, there is activity behind that screenshot. It is looking at, okay, GPS technology, how does that work? How does it ping that? How does it identify where it's at? It seems to be very, very similar to providing the foundation for cell phone tower technology.
901 asks the proponent of the evidence through the witness to say, okay, is this what this is? She says, I accessed Google services. I took these screenshots of where my phone was. It's consistent with my lived experience of where my phone was, at least 4 out of the 5 data points. That establishes a level of reliability that meets foundational requirements for Rule 901. And now,
Counsel, I need to ask you about some questions or about some issues that were raised in Mr. Clark's supplemental brief that were not addressed by the state. So I have a series of questions that I'm going to pose to you now.
Sure.
That I'd like to hear the state's position on, all right? Okay. The first is, what is your position on the fact that the search warrant was executed more than 10 days after the issuance of the warrant and the due process considerations that were raised by Mr. Clark in his brief?
The search warrant as to his home?
Yes.
Your Honor, my understanding of that issue is that that does not automatically create a due process violation if it's beyond a 10-day window. I'm sorry, I don't recall that issue being raised in his brief. I don't doubt it. But to the extent that it was, I think it was executed on the 12th day.
Yes.
That statutory violation, which it may be, does not create a due process issue lacking, I believe, lacking an element of unfairness or prejudice. Here, frankly, very little evidence was recovered with the execution of that search warrant.
And so your position is that the evidence that was introduced at trial would substantiate the verdict even without the evidence that was recovered from the delayed search warrant?
That's certainly true, Your Honor.
All right. What's your position on the allegation that he was arrested in his home without a warrant?
Your Honor, I don't have any position on that. I'm not prepared to answer that one. Sorry.
And what's your position on his argument that he was convicted, that two convictions were and sentences were entered for the same behavioral incident?
Your Honor, I don't believe that two convictions were entered for the same behavioral incident.
Two convictions and two sentences. He was concurrently sentenced.
There are two victims. Perhaps that's the reason. I did not look into that, but I believe that may be the reason.
And what's your position on the failure to instruct on a lesser included offense?
I do not believe he requested a lesser included offense instruction. And so...
So he's also arguing ineffective assistance of trial counsel. Would it be ineffective assistance of trial counsel not to ask for a lesser included instruction when the district court is required to give one? I mean, you see why I'm asking all of these questions. He's raising issues in his supplemental brief, and there's no answer in the state's response. So that's why I'm giving you the opportunity now to address them.
No, I appreciate that. I believe I did address the ineffective assistance of counsel claim in the brief.
But not with respect to not instructing on a lesser included.
Your Honor, I'll defer to the record and the law on that. I don't have an answer for the court.
All right. And then my last question is, I already asked this question. That's my last question on that issue. I don't have any other questions on.
Thank you, Your Honor. With regard to the screenshot evidence, I respectfully ask the court not to raise the bar on this. On this counsel claim, because her testimony, and I commend this court to the Oregon case that I cite in my brief. It's very close factually, and the analysis in that case is thorough. That 901 just does not require the level of foundation that appellant is asking for here. To the extent that this court is concerned about that error or any other error that Judge Frisch alluded to. There are strong reasons to find any error here harmless, even if you exclude the screenshot evidence from the victim, because there is overwhelming evidence placing appellant at the assault. She specifically identifies him as her assailant. And the evidence follows appellant from his apartment to the place where she was assaulted and back home. And there is plenty of evidence of motive and intent.
Do we think that the, or is it the state's position that the the last screen GPS screenshot is cumulative of other evidence that was presented as to Mr. Clark's whereabouts. I mean, I'm in particular, I forget what the acronym was about his cell phone report, his own cell phone report. Is it cumulative of that evidence or some other evidence?
Well, I think both of those pieces of evidence put him at Banneker and then put him back at his apartment subsequent to the assault. So to the extent, I mean, it's certainly corroborative of the victim's claim that appellant was the assailant. Because that's where he lived, even though he claimed that he had moved, which he hadn't. So cumulative, perhaps. I think all of the evidence points to appellant being at Banneker and then back at his apartment, including the video evidence, the cast evidence, and certainly the screenshot evidence.
Mr. Marker, you'd said earlier that her testimony provided or verified four of the five points. What was the one that she could not verify, and how does that tie into the harmless error analysis?
The fifth and final point, because her phone had been stolen, was that her phone was at appellant's apartment. And so, but certainly the four previous data points from a 901 perspective established the reliability for that evidence. Probably more so than is even necessary, but it certainly established the reliability for that evidence. And so then it is fair for the proponent to now argue to the jury, look, this evidence is reliable. That's where the phone was. He stole her phone, took it back to her apartment. And we know that also because of video evidence, cast evidence, and her identification of him as the assailant. Respectfully ask that you affirm this conviction. Thank you.
Thank you, counsel. Counsel for appellant, you have 5 minutes for rebuttal.
Thank you. Just to respond to your, your question about cumulative evidence, the only evidence that the victim's phone was at Mr. Clark's residence was this GPS data. There was other evidence that puts him at the scene, the state's theory of guilt, of course, but the only evidence that the phone ever went from the location of the incident to Mr. Clark's home was the GPS data.
But let's extract that evidence from the trial, right? So we still have Mr. Clark at the scene based on his cell phone report.
Well, and again, this kind of goes to our initial reliability argument, is it doesn't put him in the building. It puts him at the general location.
From which the jury could infer
absolutely
that he was there.
And if I could just briefly respond that we are not raising a sufficiency argument.
Right.
This isn't an issue of whether the state proved their case beyond a reasonable doubt as far as the evidence that as appellate review goes. The harmless error impact is an effect impact analysis. How did this evidence affect the jury's verdict? Not whether they could find him guilty without it. That's not the issue here. And our argument is that this evidence was the strongest piece of evidence that tied the state's theory of guilt together.
Was that the strongest evidence, though? Because we it seems like there's an awful lot of other evidence tying appellant to both locations and tracking his movements. We've got video camera evidence, extensive video evidence. I don't know. That seemed to be the strongest evidence to me.
Absolutely. There is other evidence. I'm not denying that at all. The point here is, could the jury, in the deliberation room, would the jury disregard this evidence and not think it's important? And I don't think the jury would ever do that, because this evidence takes the cell phone that was stolen at the location of the incident and brings it directly to Mr. Clark's home. There's no way they're not going to find him guilty with that evidence. Of course, there might be other evidence that supports the theory of guilt, but once that's introduced, what effect did that have on the jury's verdict? And that's the harmless error impact analysis. And again, it's not a sufficiency analysis. It's not whether you can infer guilt from the other evidence. It's whether this had an effect on the jury's verdict. And because the jury had this information without any ability to cross-examine an expert or any witness that had the information regarding whether this was accurate, whether we could say for certain that it was at his apartment, there was no way to adequately cross-examine about that. and it certainly affected the jury's verdict. The state also argued that the cell tower data is more elaborate than GPS data. We don't know that. We don't have that information. That's the type of information we would need from somebody when laying foundation to compare the two. Which one is more accurate? Which information could we rely on? And again, no one can say that one type of evidence is more elaborate than the other. Again, regarding the cell phone tower data, if the state used this theory for that evidence, there is evidence that Mr. Clark was at certain locations. I don't know why they would have to provide foundational evidence for the cell tower information under their theory of why they didn't need to include foundational evidence for the GPS data. It's their theory that because they know where the cell phone was earlier in the day, that therefore they don't need to have foundation for it for point B to point C. That would be the same thing for cell tower data because they have other information of where Mr. Clark may have been at certain points. So, and we know for a fact that we require cell phone tower information before it can be admitted into evidence. If the court doesn't have any other questions, we request that this court reverse Mr. Clark's convictions and remand for a new trial.
Thank you.
Thank you, counsel. Thank you both for your oral argument and your briefing. Both were very well done as usual. We appreciate that. We will be issuing an opinion within the 90-day statutory time frame. That's the last of our in-person, in-court oral arguments. We are now in recess for the next oral argument, which will be held by Zoom. Thank you both.